Station number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 16.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 16. Having got your new drafts, Mr. Hawksworth, what was the next move?
Well, having passed through the infantry reinforcement depot at Geneva, we were dispatched to Mena Camp, as I already indicated, and we were immediately put about training. Starting with at section level, leading up to platoon level, onto company, and eventually battalion level. So by the time the middle of April had been reached, we were training actively as a full infantry battalion, hoping to reach a fighting strength and efficiency in the very near future.
Other than the Irish men that you didn't do particularly well with you when you had to, and you got rid of them. What was the quality of the new drafts like?
Most of them were good, extremely good chaps. No different to ourselves. They were obviously displeased at having to join a regiment other than their own parent regiment for one reason or another. They were not rejects. I hasten to add, they'd come from the reinforcement depot at the IBD Geneva, the infantry base depot, which was an awful place, teeming with people looking for their own units. And I don't suppose that there was hardly a volunteer amongst them, unless certain individuals had had a lifelong wish to join the Durham Light Infantry. Nevertheless, most of them accepted the fact that they were there and got stuck in and became firm friends of everyone. But certain elements of the Irish types who joined us were reluctant to obey even the minor words of command, and were apt to take or attempt to take advantage of the junior NCOs, where they soon come in stuck, because in our regiment, if an order was given and not carried out immediately, the result was a disciplinary mark. Certain of our senior NCOs had clashes with them in such minor incidents as closing canteens late at night, late arrivals from passes in the town, drunken arrivals, and for some strange reason, even though amongst this Irish draft contingent, some came from the north and others came from the south. But one minute they'd be shaking hands and loving each other, and the next minute they were fighting like hell amongst themselves, which of course caused a certain amount of displeasure. And as I previously indicated, gradually, almost unnoticeably, they disappeared from our midst. Several remained, however, notably one Private Henry, who was a member of my section at the time, by which time I'd been promoted corporal. And he was a bloody good soldier. Unfortunately, he got severely wounded in the Italian campaign. But he was one Irish reinforcement who was an excellent soldier.
Were they coming from Irish regiments?
I'm not sure whether they come from an Irish regiment or from elsewhere. I don't remember them wearing headdress when they arrived, for that matter. But knowing them as I remember, they most likely discarded them on their way in any case. But as I say, their attitude caused a displeasure, certainly as far as the commanding officer is concerned, although I believe in his dim, distant past, Crackers May had Irish connections himself.
He took over command of the battalion, hadn't
yes,
he?
Yes, Crackers May came. We'd lost our CO, as history shows, who was wounded in COS, Colonel John Kirby, and Major Hugh Vaux had assumed temporary command. Crackers May, however, obviously jumped at the chance of obtaining command of his own regimental battalion, And so he ducked a more senior post at a headquarters office in Palestine. I believe a general staff officer with a parachute brigade at the time. And rejoined the battalion outside Cairo and assumed command forthwith.
Was he a good commander?
Extremely. He was a man's man, as one would say. He was well known by chaps of my ilk who joined only a few years after him. He having enlisted at Blackdown a couple of years before I did, where he was made signal officer immediately on arrival. He was he was an excellent officer in all respects. He joined in all the sport, encouraged lots of sport, and considered it to be an essential part of a soldier's training.
What happened to you next?
Well, shortly before we moved off to join the 10th Indian Division, of which we became extremely proud, a strange occasion cropped up. We being near Cairo, were suddenly detailed to move rapidly by road to Amaria, on the outskirts of Alexandria, where the Greek Brigade, I believe it was the Greek Sacred Brigade, had decided to defy all lawful commands. In other words, they mutinied against their officers. And in order to confine them to camp and eventually completely disarm them as a fighting force, our battalion was ordered to send the required detachments forthwith and take up the positions. This we did, and I was detailed as part of my company to take up a machine gun post covering a crossroads not far from the camp in which the Greeks were confined. However, it all came to nothing because once they realised that they'd been completely surrounded by a battalion known for its prowess in battle, this certainly must have made them think twice. So, but they downed their arms and conceded defeat. And so after a matter of 3 or 4 days, we were whipped back to our camp at Mina.
Did you ever discover why they'd turned against their officers?
I don't know. As usual, there were various theories put forward. Someone had said that the officers other than Greeks have been brought in, and this they didn't like. I suppose that's natural, but to refuse absolutely defy to comply with a lawful command is in fact nothing else but mutinous. And whether there were any other reasons, I know not of. But I say within a matter of 2 or 3 days, the whole affair was passed over. And they yielded to the command to lay down their arms, and we were moved back to our camp outside Cairo.
What time of the year was this?
Yeah, this was in April, during the final days of our battalion training period.
1944.
In 1944, yes.
What happened next?
Shortly after we were returned, a special day was arranged for an introductory training session when we, for the first time, met the new American Sherman tank. The main intention of this exercise was to illustrate or demonstrate the ability of this huge armoured tank at 60 tons in excess of, which could approach a rifleman's position almost silently, being diesel driven. This impressed us somewhat, and Crackers May, the CO, then blew the gaff on us all and said, "You'll be meeting plenty of these chaps, because when we join the 10th Indian Division in Italy, they'll be in support of us."
Were they an impressive tank? Were they a good tank?
Yes, they were the first tank that built in Italy, not only to carry a gun of reasonable size calibre, but they're also built with a rounded snout, which was supposed to enable them to evade direct hits. Shells landing on the front of the tank were were deflected. That I certainly never, for the remainder of my service in Italy, never saw a Sherman tank with a hole in the front.
You'd never worked with tanks before. It was part of your training working with tanks.
Oh, we had. We had worked with tanks before. We had, from the very start in the desert, infantry tanks, commonly known as I tanks, which were the platoon's pride and joy. In those days, Infantry Tank Corporation was in its infancy, of course. But we soon learnt that in a slow advance to contact, the tanks leading as silently as possible at a walking pace, they afforded a tremendous amount of protection from incoming fire. And we made friends. We got friendly with the tank regiment people, and learnt a lot through them. We also had we had tanks with us in Tobruk, of course, which were quite effective against the enemy at breakout. And on the attack against Point 157, the tanks had a field day. They fired more than 1,000 rounds. And so, yes, we had. Not previously mentioned, I admit, but we had acquainted ourselves with the Infantry Tank Corporation, and it was to be put to good use later on when we joined the 10th Indian people in Italy. So we eventually embarked and sailed for Italy on the 30th of April of 1944, and 4 days later we arrived at the port of Taranto, where we were officially welcomed into the 10th Indian Division.
What were the first impressions of Italy on landing?
Well, Taranto was in a hell of a mess. It had been early in the 1940s, one remembers, bombarded from the air by our aircraft. The Navy had participated in a sea-to-shore bombardment on more than one occasion. Our two torpedo bombers used it as a favourite target. It was in accessible reach from Alexandria and the island of Malta, in fact. And so the port itself was a bit of a wreck. The town had received severe damage, and the point of the port where we arrived had been hastily constructed by the port operating Royal Engineer Squadron. Otherwise, we couldn't have embarked safely. So that the general area at Taranto, our first sight of Italy, wasn't a very impressive one.
Did you meet up with and join the division actually in Italy itself?
We met the first elements of the Indian Division shortly after arriving, maybe 2 or 3 days after Taranto, when we pulled ourselves together and checked our kit. We moved up to an area at that time occupied by the Manchester Regiment, I remember, who were very glad to see us. They were in a plateau position, being constantly shelled by airbursts, which is always an unpleasant experience. This was our introduction to the 10th Indian Division and the type of warfare that was prevalent at that time. But the commanding officer decided that this was no fit place to base a battalion in any case, although we were in reserve. And within a matter of hours, an alternative site was chosen, and the companies were well dispersed and out of this dangerous place.
The First Battalion Dunright Infantry had been in India many, many years ago, so what was the battalion's feeling? Is it in effect linking up with an Indian division again?
Well, there were still with us in the battalion some First Battalion men, and secondly, chaps who served in the Second Battalion in India. And I think our Second Battalion, in fact, the Second Battalion, originally known as the 106th Light Infantry, who were formed in Bombay by the Bombay Trading Company or something of that order. So they were actually born in India as a battalion, a part of the regiment. Apart from which, our 2nd Battalion, just before the declaration of war, had returned from a tour of duty in India, including a long period on the Indian frontier, including Khyber Pass duties. Several of our NCOs and men at that time were wearing the Indian General Service Medal, known as the Pongi Gong.
Had you been told how the division was constituted?
We were told that, yes, we were. This was an interest. In fact, each brigade in a division consisted of the three battalions. Further down the scale, each battalion consisted of two Indian battalions and one British battalion, which in certain circumstances proved extremely favourable, because whereby the Gurkhas liked his beer issue, a certain of the Sikh, Rajputs and Baluch, who didn't partake of alcohol, handed over their share of the beer to us in return for other foodstuffs, of which there was a plentiful supply. So we soon settled down, and in fact our first brigade included not only ourselves but our first brigade included our own battalion, a battalion of Baluch and a battalion of Gurkhas, with whom we got on extremely well. In fact, from that point on, having been in action with this brigade, one of our nicknames, in fact, became the White Gurkhas, which we were very proud.
By and large, having Indians of different types, of course, and different areas in your division and brigade, what is your opinion of the Indian soldier?
Oh, extremely well-disciplined, extremely loyal to their NCO and officers, and a grimly determined fighter. If they were sent out, as I've witnessed personally more than one occasion, if they were sent out to do a job, they either did it or they didn't come back in the attempt to carry out their instructions. The Gurkhas are well known for their fighting qualities, of course, but the other battalions must be mentioned, equally fighting prowess, namely the Pathans and the Rajputana Rifles, who incidentally wore cap badges very similar to ours. A distance could be easily mistaken for a Durham Activity cap badge. The consisting of the powder horn and various other decorations. But all the battalions, far too numerous to mention here, I can't remember them all, which comprised the 10th Indian Division, were well known. The Americans were certainly overawed by the manner in which our division conducted itself, both in and out of action.
Your first position then was in reserve. What was the terrain like you were moving in?
It was it was on the Adriatic coast side, and from our first position in reserve, we moved to a place, as I recall, called San Vito, which is on the coast. It was in the rainy season, as far as I recall. It was one of the most dismal places I've ever been in my life. The things were moving rapidly as far as the fighting were concerned. There were lots of American equipment lying around, which the Yanks had discarded in their customary fashion as being second rate. And our main effort, of course, was to keep our equipment in good order and carry on with the job in hand.
Where did you move to after Veneto?
We eventually, by leaps and bounds, arrived at a place called Vanafro in June. Actually, on the 7th of June, 1944, about a month after we'd first joined the 10th Indian Div. Vanafro is a small mountain village to the east of Monte Cassino, where our 16th Battalion was situated at that time. The RSM being at that time RSM Ted Thomason, who was an ex-boy coming on his service shortly before myself. At Vanafro, the enemy had recently cleared, and we were engaged in street fighting training.
Was this new to you, this training for street fighting?
Street fighting was this was our first introduction to this type of warfare, and rapidly became known as the most dangerous. One can imagine, without me going into detail, the perilous nature of this job, clearing a house, never mind clearing a whole village or small town, where windows, doorways, and manholes offer excellent hiding places for would-be snipers. And all the way up the Italian peninsula, mainland, the Germans had adopted a lay-back system. They would withdraw in reasonably good order, leaving behind the poor men who certainly were not volunteers in concealed positions, who would choose suitable targets by the advancing Allied forces, pick them off at will. This has necessitated, of course, that before a body of the troops occupied a village, it had to be properly cleared, and this is why this training was introduced. Unfortunately for myself, this is where my lengthy period of some 7 years overseas with the battalion came to an abrupt end. It was during the street clearing training at the village of Anafro, when I was leading my section as a sergeant by this time, towards his house in order to clear it in the recognised fashion, one of our supporting sections threw grenades, assuming them to be smoke. Unfortunately for me and the man who threw it, it turned out to be an explosive grenade, which caused a certain amount of injury to my right leg and calf, and the small of the back. The immediate response from Crackers May, who was on the spot at the time, may well be realised. With certain strong language, he scooped me off the floor, and I was unable to stand, of course, slapped me onto the front of his jeep, and drove me past our regimental aid post direct to the first field ambulance he could find. And I heard him mention to the Indian doctor who was in the medical bay, "Bloody fine look, one of my best fucking cross-country runners."
How bad were your wounds?
The grenade consisted of the usual intricate mechanism, consisting of a striker, which had a sharp point, of course, a spring, and a lead ball. Upon exploding on the hard surface of the metal road where I was standing, the blast had blown me to one side, to my right, which meant that the force of the impact of the pieces of shrapnel and etc., which sharply followed, the pieces enter my upper thigh at the rear and the part of my buttock, and the whole of the mechanism penetrated the lower part of the calf of my right leg. And when I eventually reached the general hospital in Naples later that evening, before I succumbed eventually to the pentothal injection prior to an operation, the Indian doctor said to me, "We'll do our best to save it, but it's in a hell of a mess, Jim."
You must have been worried and quite frightened, but and at the same time angry. You've come through so much and got it this way.
Yes, it wasn't, as far as I'm concerned, it wasn't a fitting end to that, about half of my, or a third of my total service anyway. I'd got that far and I was enjoying it. I'd been promoted. I'd got to be sergeant in a year. I was still with my friend, Fishwick, who by that time had still beaten me by one stripe. He was then a colour sergeant, and flatly refusing to become sergeant major until I got the colour sergeant badge. And so I was happy. I was a young sergeant. I had a platoon to look after. And although we were fighting and in dangerous situations, I was enjoying life. And then this unfortunate accident occurred, because accident it was. Nevertheless, it put paid to my tour. And it was a year before I was able to rejoin the battalion in Northern Italy. But I wrote from the hospital to the battalion, and the colonel wrote back and said, "Get your bloody self back just as soon as you can, Hawkswood."
A military hospital, was that a disciplined place to be in, or was it a relaxing situation? How was it run?
Well, pre-war, I'll mention my personal experience, not mentioned in the early tapes. At one time in Shanghai, as a young boy, I contracted what was thought to be a bad case of malaria. And so I was whipped into the British Military Hospital in Shanghai. And the discipline in the hospital resembled somewhat, if not more strict than the parade ground discipline inflicted upon us by the RSM. Of course, they didn't have a hospital RSM. They had someone of more fierce than me named the matron. A regular routine in the morning, apart from the maids coming around or the ward orderlies coming around and making one in bed into a straitjacket, whenever an officer rank arrived in the ward, one had to lie to attention. And that order was given on a regular basis. Lie to attention, and we, irrespective of your state of health, you had to lie reading to your attention in bed. And everyone did. Otherwise, this matronly figure, and they were a forbidding sight. I hope my wife doesn't listen to this, because she was an ex-matron herself in the local hospital. Nevertheless, we were frightened to death of the matron, and I'm sure it helped in our rapid recovery. We were in such a bloody hurry to get out.
This hospital differed from that, the military hospital you found yourself in?
Well, the next time I went into Dock, as we used to call the hospital, was for a short spell in Korea, actually, but that comes later. The hospital in Naples, where I was based for some 6 weeks, the discipline of necessity was somewhat relaxed. In fact, the matron was a lady of Scottish birth who adopted a more motherly approach as far as the wounded sorely were concerned, and made a great foot, in fact, of all of us. The ward staff consisted mainly of trained Italian nurses who had been impressed into the job, and they, of course, spoilt us as much as the matron. So, although we're wounded and some people are still in a lot of pain, life wasn't all that bad. My main concern was the hole in my leg, which refused to heal. Although the doctors had saved the limb up to that point, the injury sustained to the muscle had severed certain veins or ligaments or whatever, and the wound, which was some 2 inches in length, an inch across, just wouldn't heal, wouldn't hit knit together. Fortunately for me, about this time, the penicillin came into being, and a homemade penicillin permanent drip was arranged to fit over this wound on my leg, and surely this was the cause of its eventual healing, because after a week of this treatment and a whole series of injections of God knows what all, the wound gradually began to heal. I never forget this course of injections. I had 42 needles in 3 days in a clockwork rotation, both in my upper arms and left and right buttock. I felt like a pincushion at the end of the week, but it worked anyway.
As you recovered, did you take part in the hospital routine?
No, thinking back, just to remark upon my previous statement, I strongly suspect, in having thought about that, the possibility, I think they were afraid I'd develop a gangrene, hence the rapid injection program. Although the wound actually closed shortly before I left the Naval Hospital for the convalescent depot at Barry, the use of my right foot had disappeared completely. The foot had dropped due to the disappearance of the nerves controlling the movements thereof. And so, for a further 2 weeks, the Italian physiotherapist of handsome countenance would come along, and he eventually made my foot move in the required direction by using a feather to tickle the sole. Strangely enough, all other medical solutions failed, but this did the trick, and my foot eventually responded, and I regained full use of it. And after some, as I say, 6 weeks in the hospital in Naples, I found myself whipped across to Barry to convalesce for a few weeks.